This is Age Well with Dr. Sophie Schotter, and this episode, along with the one that follows next week, could be one of our most interesting and important conversations yet. We are, as the title suggests, talking about some of the more holistic approaches and protocols surrounding cancer. And there are no teaser clips for this episode because, firstly, it's an extended episode, so we want to get to it quickly, but also because when the team listened back, we realized that we couldn't possibly pick just a few clips because everything Dr. Sophie talks about here is fascinating. We talk vitamins and nutritional supplements, functional mushrooms, meditation and the mind-body axis, off-license medication, autophagy and fasting, gut health, some of the new data around dental health. If you've ever felt overwhelmed by all of the information out there in this space, all bias aside, this is a great place to start because Dr. Sophie covers it all. If you know anyone who may be interested in this episode, please share it. Just a couple of clicks and you can ping it straight to their email or their WhatsApp. Everything we talk about is in the show notes, including resources for help and support. My name's Fiona Mattesini. This is Age Well with Dr. Sophie Schotter. And you're about to hear part one of how to approach cancer holistically. Thanks for listening. Okay, I think the first things, because there are a few things to say ahead of this chat, is that we're not recommending anyone goes against the advice of their doctor or oncologist. This podcast is purely a conversation based on various things that we've read and ideas we're interested in and Dr. Sophie's input. We understand as well that as yet there is limited data on some of what we're about to discuss, and clearly we always need to be led by robust data. There are also, as you will hear, conflicting viewpoints and even conflicting data pertaining to certain supplements. So we understand it can be a slightly confusing space. As always, everything we mention will be in the show notes, including the details of any studies we mention. For transparency, I want to mention that anything that I did during and after my own breast cancer treatment last year, 2023, is purely my own opinion and decision-making, not Dr. Sophie's. And a trigger warning, please know that some people may find some of the content here emotionally challenging, particularly when we talk about disease outcomes. But with all of that in mind, it's a really fascinating area of discussion. Sophie, should we start with some of the standard vitamins that everyone will have heard of and then move into some of the lesser known nutritional supplements and even off-license meds? In December 2019, a study of over 1,000 women with breast cancer found that certain nutritional supplements could reduce women's chances of survival and even increase the chance that breast cancer would recur after treatment. It was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology and led by scientists at the SWOG Cancer Research Institute. So the main findings were patients who reported taking any antioxidant, so vitamins A, C, E plus carotenoids and COQ10, were 41% more likely to have their breast cancer return if they took the supplements both before and during chemo. Patients had a similar but weaker increased risk of loss of life when taking those antioxidants. Patients taking B12, iron and omega-3s were at significantly greater risk of breast cancer recurrence and loss of life. And patients taking multivitamins showed no signs of poorer or better outcomes after chemo. Now, when I began chemo, I was told that certain supplements or vitamins could interfere with it. So I ditched everything apart from a B complex, and I later took iron because I became anemic. I did go against the pharmacist's advice in taking Chinese herbs. I worked with a reputable herbalist based on my own research, and apparently some oncology centres in Switzerland have active Chinese herbal medicine departments, and it's quite an Anglo-Saxon thing to refute Chinese herbs. But anyway, just to add, the herbs were only ever, for me, designed to support me through chemo rather than any notion of curing anything. But anyway, that's a lot to digest. What are your thoughts on all of this and this study?
So I guess I'm going to start by saying that cancer isn't just one illness. We might call it that, but it's actually a huge array of different illnesses that happen when cells start to mutate. Mm. And there's an awful lot that we're going to discuss here, which is related to cancer cells' behavior. And we have to remember that the same things that fuel our own cells to grow will also fuel cancer cells to grow. And I think the one thing I want to say above and beyond anything else is that this podcast is called Age Well. Mm. And we know that the single biggest independent risk factor for so many different illnesses, including most different types of cancer, is increasing age. Mm. And so, of course, aging is inevitable, but how we age and how we choose to look after ourselves and the health we keep ourselves in is probably the best thing we can do to minimize our risk of developing certain cancers. But what we're going to talk about here is what data there is, some of it conflicting, some of it limited, relating to how the things we put into our mouth, food and supplements, can impact cancer once it's already there. So mm-hmm. we're not talking about, can these things cause cancer? Mm-hmm. We're talking about, okay, you have cancer cells there. Is there a risk that some of these things might fuel it or might worsen outcomes from treatments? Mm-hmm. Now, onto the study you mentioned. I think it's a really interesting study. And for me, it just really reinforces why we need more understanding about how and why some supplements might fuel growth and metastasis of certain cancer cells. It's an area that lacks data, and it does cause confusion and panic. So I think you and I are both, even before your cancer journey, we've been very aware of supplements that are available. Mm. We've supplemented, we've taken good care of ourselves. But for many people, supplementation and what it can do for you isn't something that they really think about before they become unwell with something. Mm-hmm. And then they suddenly go, oh gosh, what could I do to help myself have a better outcome from this cancer? Mm. And that's the first thing that leads them to research. And then they're faced with this array of limited and conflicting data. So the first thing we have to say is that some people will have a clinical need for supplementation while they have cancer. So either because of their cancer or because of certain treatments for cancer, will be anemic and will need to supplement with iron, or may have B12 deficiencies, for example. And these things will need supplementation to keep you fighting fit through your cancer journey. Mm-hmm. And the study that you mentioned here, it is a small study, and there are other studies around that contradict this one.
Yeah.
This study found no evidence that either multivitamins or vitamin D are harmful. And that's really important that you don't take away as a message that vitamins are bad for cancer, because we'll come on to that. So I would say if you're going through active cancer treatment, the most important thing is to follow your oncologist's advice. Do try and get your vitamins and minerals, including here particularly antioxidants, from the food you eat. So bearing in mind, antioxidants really are found in fruits and vegetables. This is about eating the rainbow. Mm. Now, there are plenty of people out there who will say that whilst nutritional supplements don't do any harm, they also won't do any good. So there were 500,000 people behind the Johns Hopkins research, which concluded that multivitamins did not decrease the risk of cancer, heart disease, or help with any cognitive decline. But you will also find that there are other studies that state the exact opposite. So I think for me, really, when we've been researching this podcast, it just highlights the need for so much more research in the field of supplementation in general. There is, for example, one interesting paper by Dr. Bab Shergill of the British Association of Dermatologists, so a dermatology background. And he suggested that oral niacinamide, which is vitamin B3, has been shown to potentially reduce the rates of some types of non-melanoma skin cancer. So there are supplements that could help you potentially to decrease your cancer risk. Mm. But when we're going through active treatment, you do need to be careful, particularly with antioxidants. There was one study that showed that fish oil might reduce the effectiveness of chemotherapy. So if it was me and I was going through a cancer journey, I'd look at alternatives like possibly using milled or ground flaxseed. Mm. And again, not being afraid to discuss this with your oncology team. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think broadly speaking, there's just a potential issue that people choose to take a lot of supplements without having an indication for them and without really understanding what they're taking them for. Mm. That's why having more targeted testing, and, you know, in my clinic, we offer blood tests, and many nutritionists will use blood testing, but there are also other forms of testing available. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That can really help to screen what an individual might be deficient in. This isn't about plugging my clinic. There are many different clinics available and also home testing available that can help to decide or to decipher what your own personal nutritional needs might be. But it's important to remember that we're all different. And yeah. So blind supplementation could potentially do more harm than good.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you reinforced the fact that this particular study that I mentioned pertains to women, and it was a small study. 1,000 people feels like a lot. It actually isn't in data terms. It pertains to women in active cancer treatment, not day-to-day. And also, interestingly, it found no evidence that multivitamins or vitamin D were harmful. So I don't think people should think, oh, it's all vitamins, because actually different vitamins do very different things. And as you say, there are counter arguments. On the note of vitamin B, I also read that consuming folate and B12 has been shown to decrease the risk of cancer in people that drink alcohol.
The relationship between folate and B12 and other vitamins in certain gene pathways that lead to cancer growth isn't exactly clear. But we know that a lack of folate and other B vitamins are, according to some research at least, partly responsible for the effects of alcohol increasing your cancer risk. So potentially supplementing with folate and B12 might offset some of that increased risk. And alcohol consumption is related to quite a lot of different micronutrient deficiencies. But again, I would not take it as a guarantee that if you're drinking alcohol, but you're taking folate and B12, that you're not going to get cancer.
It's far more complicated than that. Moving on to vitamin C, my acupuncturist, and I hear how I sound when I say that, by the way, he's also a functional medicine practitioner. Now, he swears by high-dose vitamin C for cancer, as well as for COVID, long COVID, and all kinds of viruses. What are your thoughts on that vitamin C?
So vitamin C is an amazing vitamin, and there are a lot of studies to support exactly what you've said, but also there's a lack of, I guess, scientific rigor at the moment. Mm-hmm. And what we have to think here is that vitamin C is really crucial for our immune system. So if you're taking high doses of it, it can really help to bolster our immunity. Mm-hmm. But I guess if we're looking at it from the cancer perspective, so paraphrasing Cancer Research UK here, there are two studies that suggest that vitamin C's potential as a cancer treatment should be explored. And researchers in these studies were either injecting cancer patients or mice with very high doses of vitamin C. Now, much higher than you could possibly ever get from food or supplements. And that's because what we have to remember about vitamin C is if you tried to take these high doses orally, you'd have horrendous stomach problems. Mm-hmm. Because the doses we're talking about are often as much as 1 gram per kilogram. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about, you know, for your average person, really much more. Most people are taking maybe 1 gram a day. And here we're talking about 60, 70, 80, yeah, depending on how much you weigh. We're talking, yeah, about a lot. If you took all of that by mouth, your stomach would not be grateful for it. Mm-hmm. So these studies are based on intravenous vitamin C therapy. And the studies do tentatively support the idea that high-dose vitamin C has the potential as a cancer treatment, but it's far from clear-cut because other studies suggest that vitamin C could interfere with the function of certain anti-cancer drugs. So one study showed it might even stop the anti-breast cancer drug tamoxifen from working. So what I would say is we just don't have enough data to know for sure whether it's safe to take vitamin C alongside conventional treatments. It's possible it might even interfere with the way that chemotherapy works, but we don't have any proof of that. So don't worry if you've just been taking a normal dose of vitamin C whilst you're on chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. It's one of those areas that does need a lot more research, but holds promise.
Yeah.
Guiding you back towards your oncologist, because they are the one who are going to be curating and guiding your personal cancer journey.
Yeah. Can we run through a few more vitamins and also nutritional supplements that some people and even some small studies have suggested can help in cancer therapeutics? And just for transparency, I have given Dr. Sophie this list in advance. So can you go through each one for us? And I think we're going to start with vitamin D, aren't we?
Yeah, so vitamin D is such a useful vitamin that I really firmly believe everyone should be on.
Yeah.
It has a crucial role to play in the health of our immune system. And I do think this is something we have to remember here, because at various points in our life, all of us are going to have the odd cancer cell that floats around in our body. Mm. And a healthy immune system, a lot of the time, will just be able to mop up that odd stray cell and nothing will ever come of it. Mm-hmm. So it's important to remember that maintaining that immune health is key here. There is a lot of ongoing research that looks at the role of vitamin D in the development and also in the recurrence of different types of cancers. Some early stage studies suggest there might be a link between low vitamin D levels and cancer development. We obviously know it also has lots of other important health roles beyond just immunity, bone health and hormonal health. Because it's a fat soluble vitamin, that's part of why it has such a strong hormonal activity as well, because it regulates so many different pathways within the human body. And in the UK, it's impossible to get enough vitamin D from food alone. And unless you live in a really sunny climate year round and you're going out very regularly without wearing sunscreen, which of course we know increases your risk of skin cancer and aging, you are almost certainly deficient or suboptimal. So I hope I'm getting across, this is one that I really do firmly believe we should all be on. But since it's a fat-soluble vitamin, it's also important that you don't neglect taking and supplementing with other fat-soluble vitamins alongside it. So K2 is a really important one. And it's also a really good idea to take it with things like avocado, olive oil, oily fish, because, again, these will improve its absorption. And whilst we're talking about K2, it is actually in its own right a very common nutrient deficiency in the Western world. And it's also really important for controlling inflammation. There was one particular study that found that vitamin K2 was effective at helping to inhibit pro-inflammatory substances in the spinal cord and in the brain's immune system. This was in rats who had multiple sclerosis symptoms. So it's something that can be potentially really helpful for helping us to control systemic inflammation, which we know from a health preventative perspective, we should be controlling.
Yeah.
And if you're looking to get a supplement for K2, I would look for a version called MK4. And this is because it's been shown to regulate gene expression in specific ways that no other form of vitamin K seems to. And it seems to play this exclusive role in both cancer protection and sexual health.
Okay, what about bromelain?
Bromelain is a natural enzyme that's found in pineapples, actually predominantly in kind of the core bit of the pineapple. And there are some studies coming through that show that bromelain might help to prevent or treat certain cancers. And that's possibly helping to stop those cancers from growing. It's also one that you can use alongside other cancer treatments. It's actually one I use or recommend quite a lot in clinic for patients who are prone to bruising, because it's excellent for helping with that. But there have been laboratory and animal studies that have shown that bromelain might reduce inflammation for certain different types of skin condition and also possibly even help with osteoporosis. You hear me saying a lot of mights and maybes, because this is not definitive evidence, but it's one that on the balance of probability seems to be a fairly safe bet.
Yeah, and just to reinforce that we've taken this list from Cancer Research UK, so we're not blindly plucking these out. And a lot of, in fact, all of the studies that we mentioned are on that website. So we are trying to apply a bit of rigor with this entire podcast as much as we can. I hadn't heard of this one, ESIAC.
No, I have to admit, when this was on the list, it was one I had to look up myself. So this is one I'd personally be a little bit more skeptical about. It's a herbal remedy that originated in Canada. It's a mixture of roots, bark and leaves that you boil up to make a drinkable liquid, although I can't say it particularly sounds delightful to drink. You can also buy it as capsules or drops. And there's a modified version of it, which is called Floor Essence. Now, there are some studies and reviews about it that have shown that ESIAC hasn't got any anti-cancer effects. And certainly trying to unpick it myself, I can't see how or why it would. But it is still one that anecdotally some people refer to. And therefore, if you're listening to this podcast from a personal interest perspective and on your own cancer journey or looking for information for someone you love, this is one I'd be a little bit more skeptical about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. And another one I hadn't heard of, Latril.
Yeah, so I had heard of this in a different context, but Latril is a man-made synthetic form of something called amygdalin. And amygdalin is a plant substance that you find in the seeds of apricots and cherries or raw nuts or bitter almonds. There are some people who call this vitamin B17, but it isn't a vitamin. So when the body processes Latril or Latril, I still don't know how to pronounce it, it converts it to cyanide. Now, cyanide is a type of poison. I'm sure it was Agatha Christie who first brought this to my awareness when I was a child, and I think it was a Poirot or something along the way. But cyanide is thought to potentially kill cancer cells. Now, again, let's come back to the fact that cancer cells are just cells. And it's not surprising that cyanide kills them, because it would kill you as well, potentially, if you had enough of it. So this is a really strong poison. So there's no reliable scientific evidence to show that either Latril or amygdalin can treat cancer. And certainly it isn't being converted into significant doses of cyanide in your body that cause you to die, which is what ingesting cyanide would do. So again, this is one that I am very skeptical of and cynical about.
You've reminded me, actually, that I interviewed Dame Deborah James, gosh, about 5 years ago, I think. I was doing some work for the Eve Appeal, which I want to give a mention to, and the CEO, Athena, who I think it's the only UK charity that deals with the five female gynecological cancers. And when I spoke to Deborah, she mentioned this, and I remember it because of the apricot, and she was very dismissive. In fact, I'll be honest, and I think she has publicly said this, so I don't think I'm speaking out of turn here, but she was dismissive of a lot of things, and that was one that she raised. Anyway, turmeric, and I know we've talked about this one before, haven't we?
Yeah. So turmeric is a spice that belongs to the ginger family, and it's the main ingredient in curry powder. It's what gives it its yellowish colour. There have been population studies to suggest that particularly rates of certain GI cancers, gastrointestinal cancers, are lower in populations where a lot of turmeric is eaten. So think particularly India here, for example. Mm-hmm. And so the main ingredient, active ingredient in turmeric, is something called curcumin. And laboratory studies have shown that curcumin seems to be able to kill cancer cells and prevent them from growing. And there have even been some clinical trials looking at curcumin in people who've got colorectal cancer, prostate cancer, and some other types of cancer as well. So this is one I do think is interesting. If you're going to take curcumin, the best way to take it is together with black pepper, because black pepper contains something called bioperin, which increases the absorption of the curcumin.
Yeah, and my supplement does have black pepper with it, so you don't have to get the pepper grinder out. Right, another interesting one is ginger.
Yes, ginger is one where there has been some research. So a 2006 study from the University of Michigan found that ginger not only killed ovarian cancer cells, but prevented them from building up resistance to cancer treatment. So again, one that is interesting, but we have quite limited research. And what's always difficult is so much research and development goes into developing drugs that can be patented by the pharmaceutical company who have invested in developing this drug and spent a lot of money on the clinical trials. And of course, a supplement or a foodstuff like ginger can't be patented. And so there tends to be far less commitment and desire to spend a lot of money on clinical trials for these substances. And it's a big frustration for many researchers and for us who would love to know more.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to reinforce the fact that just as we need a healthy dose of skepticism with a lot of the stuff that we're talking about because we need research, you're absolutely right. We should also have a healthy dose of skepticism in terms of pharmaceutical companies who, as you say, are not investing investing in some of these things because they can't really make much money from ginger root because, frankly, it's so readily available. What about selenium?
Selenium is a really interesting mineral. It removes free radicals from the body. And so free radicals are these unstable reactive oxygen species that attack cells and can eventually lead to cancer if they're not controlled and removed. Mm-hmm. So too much selenium can be toxic, but doses as high as about 300 micrograms have been shown to reduce certain kinds of cancers. So this includes lung, liver, and colon. One trial even showed that selenium might protect against the overall risk of prostate cancer in men who have a history of non-melanoma skin cancer. So that's quite a niche population we yes. have to remember here.
Yes.
But then again, a later systematic review, which is again a top tier of scientific evidence, found that selenium supplements had no benefit. And some randomized controlled trials along the way have shown a higher incidence of high-grade prostate cancer and type 2 diabetes in people taking selenium. Mm-hmm. So it's an area that has a lot of mixed results. Even though we have some research, it's leading to conflicting outcomes. So when I talk about doses as high as potentially 300 micrograms, I want to caveat that with that the recommended daily amount is actually 55 micrograms. And mm-hmm. you can get that dose via supplements, eating something like Brazil nuts, which are rich in selenium.
Yeah.
I guess the people who most commonly might be on selenium are those with thyroid problems who are following a kind of a proactive nutritional approach to supporting thyroid health.
Now, we're not going off piste exactly, but so far we've covered a lot of things that Cancer Research UK has covered, but there are some other things I want to move on to. Garlic, for one thing. Should we talk about garlic?
Yeah, doesn't just keep the vampires away, but there are studies that have suggested that garlic has properties that block the activation of certain cancer-causing substances and therefore reduce the growth of cancer cells.
Yeah, okay. I used to, when my kids were small, I used to actually, this sounds so disgusting, when I was doing fresh juice, I would actually put a bit of garlic in their fresh juice as well, which is such a hippie mum. Now, green tea, we've both bonded over the fact that we know it's good for us, but we neither of us really particularly like it. But let's talk about green tea.
Yep, absolutely. I think I was fortunate enough to go to Japan a couple of times in my teens, and I had so much green tea there in such a short space of time that I just developed this slight aversion to it. But there are several studies that show it can help to protect against certain kinds of cancer. There are chemicals in green tea called polyphenols that have both antioxidant and anti-inflammatory properties. I've mentioned the word antioxidant here. So if it's something you naturally are drinking a lot of anyway, and you are at the start of a cancer journey, or it's something you're thinking about, talk to your oncology team. You can either choose to drink it or you can take it in capsule form, but the capsules can be quite concentrated. And it's important to remember again that those will contain caffeine. So if you are taking capsules, think about that with the timing of your supplements.
Yeah, people don't realize that green tea is very high in caffeine, as is dark chocolate. What about vitamin E?
Vitamin E is a potent antioxidant and actually also synergistic with vitamin C, mm-hmm. Helping the body to remove these cell-damaging free radicals. Studies do show it can decrease the risk of prostate, colon, and lung cancer. And also, in fact, that if you are deficient in vitamin E, there is an increase in your risk of cancer overall. Mm-hmm. So it is one you can supplement or get through your diet. But again, it's an antioxidant. So whilst you're going through active cancer treatment, be careful.
One more, just for the purposes of this particular list. I've got another list brewing in the background. Sorry, Sophie. Iodine. Let's talk about iodine.
There are lots of theories about supplements such as iodine. And I'd recommend generally taking, for most people, unless you're under nutritional guidance, spirulina. So spirulina is often called a superfood and it comes from a blue-green type of algae in the sea. And it's a very good source of iodine as well as iron and also lots of other phytonutrients. So yeah, one to look at.
Yeah. And I also want to pick up on something you've said, because I didn't realize this until quite recently, when you said that all of us have cancer cells floating around in our body, which is something I've discussed with my oncologist. People don't realize that actually we do. But what happens is our immune systems will fight them off. This is early stage cancer cells, by the way. Our immune systems fight them off and it never becomes cancer. So I think it's important to say that because it's just interesting.
cancer cells are just a cell of your body that has mutated and something's just gone wrong with how it replicates itself along the way.
Yeah.
And that because of the way our cellular processes age, it does become more common usually with age. It's something a lot of the time, these errant one or two cells which have been wrongly copied will be mopped up. Your immune system knows what to do with it.
Yeah.
And then just sometimes it can take hold and these cells multiply and you develop a tumour.
Yeah, and I've got some interesting things to ask you about in terms of immune system, but we'll get to that. Just for reference, that big long list that we've done, I take most of those that you've mentioned. My cupboard just rattles. I'd say I take about 2/3 of those, maybe a bit more, including I take a quercetin and bromelain combined supplement. And I'm trying to persuade myself to get onto the green tea. But I do love my coffee in the morning and I take that as well. I also take turkey tail. Quite recently, I've got onto this. And now we released an episode on mushrooms last year and we mainly focused on aesthetics and the skin. But of course, there's a whole host of research on what mushrooms and adaptogens can do in the cancer space.
Yes, I mean, adaptogenic mushrooms and herbs have a balancing effect on something called your hypothalamic pituitary endocrine axis. That's your HPE axis. This is the sort of dance between your brain and your hormones. So within that, we've got your brain adrenal axis, which is your HPA axis, and you've got your brain thyroid axis, which is your HPT axis, and you've got your brain gonadal axis, so that's your sex organs, your HPG axis. Mm-hmm. And we need all of these communication systems working in perfect harmony for a healthy mood, metabolism, energy levels, your immune system to be in top form, and also a healthy sex drive.
Mm-hmm.
So your HP axis, it also controls hundreds of different pathways responsible for inflammation in the body. And because we know that chronic inflammation is linked to cancer as well as many other health issues, adaptogenic mushrooms are really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There are several studies that show impressive results with cancer patients. And I think it's probably sensible for us to link to those in the show notes so that people mm-hmm. can go and read a little bit more and look at the information themselves. But the mushrooms included in these studies are shiitake, one that I'm going to try and pronounce, but Himematsutake mushroom, which is known as God's mushroom, the shaga mushroom, and maitake mushroom. And then there's also turkey tail. And turkey tail is interesting in that it also has data on it potentially helping something called SIBO, which is small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and potential candida yeast overgrowth. So yeah, I definitely think mushrooms are another thing that people should be looking at.
I'm also on lion's mane for brain fog. That's another one that's had a lot of interesting research. Now, what about soy, especially when it comes to breast cancer?
Yeah. So people worry about soy products because soy products contain something called isoflavones. And these are chemicals that are known for their health benefits, but structurally are quite similar to our natural hormone, estrogen. And since estrogen can stimulate growth in some cancers, such as breast cancers, not all breast cancers, there are people who worry that foods or soy supplements might have that same effect as estrogen and therefore cause their cancer to grow.
Mm-hmm.
But caveating that, current research seems to suggest that foods containing natural isoflavones are safe, even potentially not just safe, but beneficial. So the theory here is that in breast and prostate cancer, isoflavones could actually reduce the risk of cancer coming back. And that's because they are structurally so similar to estrogen. They bind to the estrogen receptors on our cells, and in doing so, potentially block estrogen from binding to the cancer cell and activating it.
Mm.
So it's potentially quite interesting.
Yeah, thank you for that. I want to talk more specifically about two supplements in particular, NAD Plus, which I know is in your stack, along with glutamine. Now, there are theories that, and I want to word this carefully, there are theories that NAD Plus can not only feed healthy cells, but also feed cancer cells. And this goes back to what you were saying at the very start of this chat, which is that we have to remember that cancer cells are living cells and they need something to keep them living and alive. Regarding glutamine, there is a similar outlook. So what are your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, it's exactly what you said. Cancer cells are just cells. They need the same things to keep them alive that a skin cell does, or that a healthy lung cell does, or that a cardiac heart cell does. Mm-hmm. So they need glucose, they need oxygen, and they need NAD plus, because mm-hmm. NAD plus is our cellular energy currency. But there is no research at all to show that NAD plus can cause cancer. We all have it in our bodies in abundance. And actually our levels are highest when we're very young, when we're mm-hmm. children, when we're first born, when our cancer risks are lowest. Mm-hmm. So again, remember what I said at the top of the podcast, that the biggest independent risk factor for most types of cancer is increasing age, and NAD plus levels decrease progressively with age. They've mm-hmm. halved by roughly the age of 20, and they've halved again by the age of 40. Mm. So there is no research to show that NAD plus can cause cancer. But what the studies do show is that if you cut off the NAD plus supply to a cancer cell, the cell will die. Mm-hmm. Of course it will. That surely that's intuitive, because mm-hmm. you're cutting off its energy currency. It mm-hmm. it can't provide energy anymore. Mm-hmm. And the mm-hmm. same goes with glucose and oxygen. If you stopped breathing oxygen, your cancer cells would die. Mm-hmm. So would you. And if you took away glucose, which is its main metabolic source, it would also die. So it's not a sensible or indeed a viable approach to restrict these critical molecules. However, supplementing to increase your NAD plus levels while you're going through active cancer treatment, again, is probably something I would advise significant caution with, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. you would then be increasing your levels of something that can feed your cancer. Mm-hmm. So we're looking mm-hmm. at two very different things. One is potentially a preventative approach to health management in someone without cancer. And the other bit of advice is to someone going through a cancer journey.
Yeah, yeah.
And with glutamine, the simple answer is yes, that there does appear to be a link between glutamine and cancer. Cancer cells seem to use glutamine to grow, survive, multiply, and so much so that they can become utterly dependent on it. But it's complicated, because on the flip side, it could also improve the outcome of certain mm-hmm. cancer cases. So it's such an important part of tumor progression that some researchers are studying it as a potential cancer treatment. It's got great potential for immune enhancement and boosting, partly because it acts as this primary fuel for your lymphocytes, which are a type of white blood cell that help your body's immune system to fight viruses and bacteria. So doctor-supervised glutamine supplementation could be of value in healing various tissues affected by chemotherapy or radiation. And it's also been shown to have positive cognitive benefits. And it's a brilliant one for gut integrity, such an important gut supplement. I think another thing to realize is that there is research that shows that higher blood glutamine levels could be protective against cardiovascular disease. So it's very complicated here. Glutamine is the most abundant amino acid found in the human bloodstream. So is it beyond the realm of understanding that as an amino acid and a building block of protein, and that proteins form such integral and crucial parts of every cellular metabolic process in the human body, that cancer cells need it? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You can see how that can be. You can find glutamine not just as a supplement, but also in food. Generally, foods with a high protein content will have most glutamine in it, so meat and other animal products like dairy. And you'll also find it in raw spinach. Mm-hmm. So I would say, back to this whole thing of there's more research. I don't know about you guys, but even with what I'm saying here, trying to spell it out in these are the studies that say one thing, these are the studies that say another,
yeah,
it's not a clear-cut message of it's a problem or it isn't. So
yeah,
go back to talking to your oncologist if you're going through an active cancer journey. If you're going through treatment, wait until you're finished before starting or going back on either of these two supplements. And in principle, have a conversation with your doctor. But again, it's important to remember that a lot of Western doctors are not that well-versed in nutritional approaches. So it might be something that you find in the private sector, that you find a practice that follows a more functional approach that can marry advice on where Western medicine and your diet and lifestyle meet.
Yeah, great advice. And I think it's really important what you also said about how we need more research. And yes, it can be overwhelming. And I think for anyone going through cancer at the moment or a loved one who has cancer, I know personally how overwhelming all of this can feel and how much decision-making and admin cancer can bring. And we do have to advocate for ourselves and do the research ourselves, because that's not what the UK healthcare system is designed to do or able to do. And I certainly respect all of the oncology teams out there, one of which saved my life. And I feel very grateful to have had access to chemo as well as access to all of my other complementary therapies and protocols that I believe made a huge difference in my own recovery. And as we've said, pharmaceuticals, they are not inclined to do a lot of this research for reasons that we won't go into now. And this podcast really is designed to open a few doors and offer a few signposts so people can hopefully go off and do their own research. We're going to wrap there for part one. We're going to come back for part two. But for now, thank you so much, Sophie.
Thank you, Fee. I just find it so stimulating talking with you about all of this.
And that ends our podcast. If you want to explore more of what we talked about, simply head to the show notes. We've done all of the research and noting down of names, ideas, any studies we mentioned, so you don't have to go digging. To be ahead of the latest episode, press follow on Apple Podcasts. That's the little cross on the top right. Or simply hit follow on Spotify or whichever podcast app you use. Also, do follow Sophie on Instagram and TikTok. There's loads of great content and little explainers on there. Search for Dr. Sophie Schotter. Finally, if you're close to London or Kent, you can book a consultation with Sophie and find out more about who she is and the range of treatments and services she offers via drsophieschotter.com. And by the way, there's some great blog content on the website too. My name's Fiona Mattesini. On behalf of myself and Sophie, please do take a moment to rate and review the show. It all helps. And of course, thanks for listening.